This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm John Davis. State lawmakers are back in Tallahassee for the third week of the 2018 Florida legislative session, and today we kick off the third week of WGCU's own series of legislative roundtable discussions. Attorney and Republican State Representative Heather Fitzenhagen represents Florida House District 78, which includes a large swath of Fort Myers. She recently stopped by our studios for an in-depth conversation about the state budget, environmental proposals, the opioid crisis, and other hot-button issues, including how the Me Too movement is being addressed in the state capitol. Of course, we also explored the bills she's looking to champion through the legislature this year, which touch on a broad range of issues, including health care, education, human trafficking, and fracking, just to name a few. Let's hear that conversation now. Well, State Representative Heather Fitzenhagen, thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
And to start off, I wanted to talk about the one thing, really, that you and your fellow lawmakers are constitutionally required to do, and that's to pass a balanced budget. And, you know, Governor Scott has proposed an $87.4 billion budget plan. It's $2.4 billion more than the current fiscal year budget. It includes, you know, many proposals that are popular with voters, like a $180 million tax cut package, a $1.7 billion investment in Florida's environment. However, that meager surplus that we had been anticipating before Hurricane Irma, as we know, means that was wiped out, and we've entered the session in a little bit of a deficit in the red. And I was just wondering if you had any thoughts or insights on how lawmakers can address Governor Scott's budget priorities with these funding challenges.
Well, I think you've really made a great assessment of what we have to deal with. We don't have a lot of extra money this time around. In fact, we are a little bit in the red. But we're going to have to, like we always do, have to make some very tough choices. I think the aspirations of Governor Scott's bill are excellent, but we just don't have the wherewithal to fund it. And we do have a lot of important things to fund. As you and your listeners probably know, the economic funding of our environmental projects is key for me, especially for us here in Southwest Florida. So I want to emphasize that I'm going to be trying to make sure that those get as funded as possible. There are a lot of different water bills that are in the pipeline that will help reduce flooding, which in turn will help reduce costs as we go into the years in the future, because part of the big problems that we had from Irma that are costing us so much is the flooding that we had to deal with.
While we're on the subject of, you know, environmental concerns, you know, Scott specifically is proposing that $1.7 billion investment in the environment. That includes $100 million for post-Irma beach restoration, $40 million increase in spending for state parks, and $355 million for Everglades restoration, also $50 million for the state's mainland conservation program, Florida Forever, which, you know, as we know, last year wasn't given any money, and in years before the Great Recession used to enjoy some, you know, $300 million a year in appropriations. And I know you're kind of in a unique position as the being on the House Agriculture and Natural Services Appropriations Subcommittee and the Chamber's Natural Resources and Public Lands Committee. Do you generally support the governor's budget proposals that relates to environmental spending?
I mean, I do support them, but I also am a realist, and I know that we have other areas where we are going to need to put money. We have an opioid crisis on our hands that we're going to have to think about. We always have an ongoing crisis in the state with mental health funding. So as much as I would like to fully fund all of those proposals, that's not going to be possible. We're going to have to look at them and try to, as a body, determine which ones are the priorities for this year and which ones are going to have long-term return on investment that we can bank on.
That's right. It always comes back to return on investment whenever we talk.
It does. That's what it's all about.
That's right. I wanted to talk about the tax cut proposal as well, because you know, the $180 million in tax cuts Scott is calling for, it's actually his smallest tax cut proposal over his two terms in office. But it's kind of a big shift too, because in the past we've seen proposed tax cuts for businesses, and these ones seem more focused on, you know, having a tangible impact on individual homeowners, you know, bottom line. guidelines, mm-hmm. You know, with things like sales tax holidays for school, mm-hmm. as well as for, you know, hurricane supplies, things mm-hmm. along those lines. Is that something that you think we're going to be able to do? It seems like that'd be really popular with voters.
Well, I think it is popular. And as a resident of the state of Florida, it would be popular to me. But putting on my lawmaker hat, my legislative hat, I have to think, is that the best way for us to be spending our money to return an incremental amount that will have some impact on families but may also have a negative impact on what the state can do to address larger problems going forward? I am very much a proponent of the sales tax holidays, and we do have them now. I'm not 100% certain if it's going to be possible for us to extend those when we are in a financially strapped situation. As much as I would like to have that little extra bump, I think, well, maybe I might want to say, no, I don't want to take it this time because I know those dollars need to be allocated for very important issues that we're facing.
Education spending seems like it's always going to be a contentious issue. Given the tight budget projections we've talked about, how do you think lawmakers could look for, you know, paying for proposed increases in K-12 education spending? And I'm wondering if any positions that you might hold on that would take into account the fact that the Lee County School District is among this consortium of districts that have filed a lawsuit against the education funding package that was passed in the current fiscal year budget, requiring them to share a portion of their allocation from the state with charter schools.
Well, my philosophy is this. I think there is definitely a place for charter schools. I also support our public education system wholeheartedly. We have a tremendous number of hardworking teachers and administrators and staff at our schools. But I do like the idea that every child doesn't have a cookie cutter education, that parents have choices. So as it pertains to the lawsuit, I can't really comment except to say that I think it's great that in this country we can have that ability to address things in the courts. And so if they are not feeling that that is the right way or a legal means to address our education issues, I like that we have that ability to go and resolve it. But I'm not going to weigh in on the merits of the lawsuit itself.
Gotcha. And let's touch on the opioid crisis too, because that's something that's been getting a lot of attention. And of course, everybody wants to address it. That's not a partisan issue.
Of course.
But the number of opioid-related deaths here in the state increased 35% in 2016. And that's according to a report released late last year by the State Department of Law Enforcement. And that report, you know, based on data collected from medical examiners across the state, finds that overdose deaths caused by fentanyl, that powerful synthetic opioid, shot up 97% last year, and that the presence of fentanyl in overdose victims increased 80%. I mean, these are some pretty dramatic numbers.
Well, fentanyl is the devil. I mean, there is nothing good about fentanyl. It has no place in being used for any purpose. It's just a terrible, terrible drug. So that's part of the opioid crisis, and I think there are a lot of ways we have to address that. Obviously, education for people to understand that fentanyl kills. It's just so deadly, and that the law enforcement has a big problem on its hands because there are a lot of aggressive people trying to put fentanyl on our streets, and they are going to have to be able to continue to be vigilant to combat that. And then the other side of it is when those fentanyl victims perish, they are leaving a whole host of other problems behind that are costly from an emotional standpoint for families and costly for the state of Florida to be able to deal with when we have to take care of those that are left behind from those tragedies.
And for you to support, you know, some sort of bill as it would relate to addressing the opioid crisis, would you need to see something in there regarding, you know, recovery?
I am a big proponent of recovery, but that kind of just segues right into my favorite topic, which the reason we have people in recovery is because they have some mental health concerns that need to be addressed. So I would like to see us as a state move much more quickly to try to do screening and work on mental wellness for our kids, and so that we can start a different pattern of what's happening and be a leader in this area rather than towards the back of the bus in terms of what we're doing to address mental wellness.
And I wanted to also ask you about Governor Scott's budget priorities as it relates to the opioid crisis. He's called for establishing a 3-day limit on prescribed opioids unless some strict conditions are met that would allow them to expand that to a 7-day supply. And House Speaker Corcoran and Senate President Negron have both said that they support Governor Scott's proposals in this area. But I've also heard some criticism of that, saying this is well-intended, but it might be addressing the wrong opioid crisis, because we really tackled that whole pill mill issue a while ago.
Well, every action has a reaction. And so every time we do something that is intended and does have some positive impact, it can also have a ramification that we aren't anticipating. As we did when we shut down the pill mills, people that were seeking those pills tried to get them by a different means. And so if we address the opioid issue with prescription opioids, we may not be casting a strong enough or wide enough net to catch what we really want to, which is this street opioids like fentanyl that are being – they're ones that are really killing people. I have talked to a number of experts in this field, and there is some controversy about whether or not this is the approach that's going to be ultimately effective, because there's a percentage of people that do get hooked on prescription opioids, but I don't know if it's going to be the means to really solve it. I think the fentanyl crisis, people may choose to go to more street drugs if they can't get a more supply of their prescription drugs. I think that we need to monitor it. But I also am concerned that when people get a more limited prescription – again, I it's very hard. It's a lot of different moving parts here. People get a prescription. If it's limited and you have acute pain from something, say you got a hip replacement and you get 3 days worth or 5 days, whatever it is, of the pills, I worry that people that are in this pain, you know, they are going to then have to go back to their doctor if they can get another appointment. Let's start with that. Can you get the appointment? Then they're going to have to physically get to that appointment. And a lot of people, you know, are – you know, have difficulty doing that. They may either not have the wherewithal to be taking, you know, rides and getting a transportation to their doctor. They may not have a loved one at home that can get them there safely. So we don't want them trying to get there on their own necessarily. There's a lot of problems.
Yeah.
So I'm going to be looking at that very closely and weigh in ultimately with something I think that's will give my opinion on it, but I'm not sold on it.
Gotcha.
What I am sold on, however, is an increased use of Narcan. I would like to see Narcan everywhere if we want to save lives and then try to get people into some kind of a rehab program, because Narcan can save lives. And that's what we are ultimately trying to do.
So, and not to put words in your mouth here, but if we did move forward in the legislature with these proposed limits on prescription opioids, I'm getting the idea that you would probably like to see some sort of exception for those with legitimate chronic pain issues.
Well, there is an exception for chronic pain.
Okay.
Chronic pain, ongoing pain, as it currently is written, I believe there is an exception. But I also am concerned about people with acute pain that is going to last a little bit longer than, you know, the limit that we're talking about. So it's a delicate balancing act between trying to make sure we address patients' necessity for pain relief without over-prescribing. And I understand that. So it's a discussion that I think is going to be robust at the Capitol, and a lot of people are going to be weighing in. And as we always do, we will try to do the best we can to find the right solution.
And I wanted to switch gears a little bit and talk about, you know, this growing, you know, the hashtag MeToo movement that's been empowering so many women all over the country from so many different industries to come forward with their stories of dealing with sexual harassment and sexual abuse. And of course, the Florida legislature has not been exempt from that. Your colleague, Lisbeth Beniquisto in the Senate, came forward with allegations against a former lawmaker, Rich Workman, and that ended up ending with him not taking a position he'd been appointed to begin just this month. And of course, former Senate Budget Chief Jack Latvala, as we all know, resigned shortly before the session began over allegations of sexual harassment. And, you know, we've learned that Governor Scott will not be calling for a special session to fill Latvala's vacant seat. So there are ripple effects just more generally in the legislature. But I'm wondering if, from your perspective, is this having a palpable impact on the culture in the state capitol right now? And is this something that you personally have dealt with, either in the legislature or just in your time living on this earth and being a woman?
Wow, that's a lot of questions.
I know.
How much time do we have? Yes, I have personally dealt with it. It was a long time ago. And I think generally speaking, in my experience, these types of situations occur when there's a tremendous imbalance of power between the male and the female, or the person with the power and not the power. So when you're talking about people that are on a relative par of power, which is most of us in the legislature, I think it comes down to needing more education. You're always, I think, going to have, unfortunately, not necessarily in the legislature, but in the world, people in power that are going to exert that power in some way or another, and some try to exert it in the form of sexual harassment. We've seen that everywhere. But I think that sometimes, you know, there needs to be a conversation about, hey, you know, sexual harassment is a personal thing. What you might believe is sexual harassment, someone else might not think it's sexual harassment. It's how do I feel? Do I feel harassed? But we have to make our rules that will apply to, would a normal average person feel harassed in this situation? And so I think we need to have a basic understanding of where that bright line is. But then I think people need to communicate. I mean, if you are uncomfortable with someone, I have no problem telling them, hey, stop it. And, you know, no, you've got to communicate these things and be a strong individual, whether you're a man or a woman. And I think that we just need to make sure that we communicate that. I have never, since I've become a more mature woman, have not felt in any way harassed, because I have no problem making a retort to anything that would make me feel uncomfortable. Or said differently, there's very little that, you know, I'm going to allow to happen that's going to make me feel uncomfortable. I think you have to just take charge and try to have a communication.
Yeah. I mean, and at the same time, though, I mean, you're talking about people, you know, the importance of speaking out, and we're seeing that more and more. That's what's part of this movement. But I mean, do we need some sort of protections in place? Because I think a lot of what's behind this movement is the women who are coming forward now, they knew they were being harassed and they didn't feel that they could come forward without facing repercussions or losing their jobs.
And I completely understand that, because that's the situation I found myself in. When I was a young person and I had a job and I didn't have the ability to just go out and get another one with the snap of a finger, I counted on that to pay my rent. I counted on it for all those things. It was like a lifeblood to me. So when I was harassed at the workplace and told that if I didn't do X, Y, and Z, I was going to get fired, well, I went right to my boss and I said, gee, you know, this is inappropriate. And they said, sorry, we want that person to be happy at the firm and we want you to do whatever is necessary. So I completely understand. So if you're in that grave of a situation where the power is so far split between you and the harasser, I get it. But if you are in some place where you can speak to others, or, you know, find a way to communicate this, I think we have to. But there always should be protections. No one should feel that they have nowhere to turn. That is not appropriate.
And of course, sexual harassment training is something that's already required by members of your chamber. Mm-hmm. There's a proposal to add something similar to members of the Senate. And then we have Senator Lauren Book and Representative Kristen Jacobs filing companion bills proposing up to a $10,000 civil penalty increase for public officers and lobbyists, excuse me, who engage in sexual misconduct. It would also create this task force in charge of preventing sexual misconduct and harassment in the workplace, particularly in government settings and as it's applied to, you know, the conduct of public officers and lobbyists. Do these just seem like common sense, prudent measures to you?
Well, I think that, again, sexual harassment should not be allowed. And I think there should be something, a ramification if you engage in it. At the same time, we are up there working together, and I don't want it to have a chilling effect on the communication that we have as legislators and lobbyists. So you walk a fine line. I definitely think that their proposal is very well intended, and I'm going to look at it and consider it very thoughtfully. But I also don't want to put a complete damper on the ability of men and women to interact without feeling that they have to watch every single word they say because it might be misinterpreted and lead to an allegation. So there's got to be a middle ground. And I think as we move away maybe from the crisis that we've just experienced in the legislature with these incidents occurring, we can kind of have a more thoughtful view of how to approach this. And this may be the right way. But I don't want to find as well, women aren't invited to a particular function because the majority of the members and lobbyists who are men might think, you know, it's just not really worth it to me to have to even concern myself with this.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Well, let's segue a little bit and look at some of the bills that you're specifically sponsoring this session. And I wanted to start with your proposal that would eliminate state oversight of where hospitals can be constructed by way of eliminating the certificate of need requirement. Does this relate to, you know, the local issues over certificate of need that have prevented both Lee Health and NCH from building a full-fledged hospital on properties that they own in the Estero area? Because that's something that's been an ongoing issue here for years. And I'm wondering if that's what started this for you.
No, it did not start it for me. What started it for me is I have served on the Health Quality Committee in the past, and the philosophy that I have really embraced while I'm serving at the House of Representatives is one of removing barriers to competition and being able to have more transparency in everything that we do. So this is part of a suite of bills and activities that we are doing as a legislature to make healthcare more transparent and affordable. So I look at it as just another piece of the puzzle to be able to let you and I go to the place that we want to for our care, be able to price out what that care is, be able to examine the doctor's background and so on, so that we as consumers of one of the most important things that you could possibly consume, healthcare, we'll have those choices.
And this is sort of tangentially related, but you've also sponsored the Recovery Care Services Bill aimed at authorizing the Agency for Healthcare Administration, ACA, to establish separate standards for recovery care centers. Is this similar to bills you've sponsored that we've spoken about in the past related to lifting restrictions on, you know, non-hospital surgery centers and really expanding patient options?
I would say that the part that I completely align with of what you just said is expanding patient options. By allowing a recovery care center to extend its hours to serve patients, which is what this is about, we are giving an option for a patient that might want to just have some observation and be more comfortable in that setting, who might not have a responsible adult waiting at home to take care of them, to choose that because they just will feel more comfortable and the doctor would feel more comfortable giving them that extra little time of recovery. Because right now our model is we're trying to get people up and out of the hospital setting as quickly as we can, which is good, but we also we just need to have the right balance, you know, and have individual choices for patients that doctors can make. So the quality of care, would not suffer. The requirements of what is necessary to make ensure that patients are safe would not suffer, in my estimation. Again, it's just trying to give more choices and more options to people like me. If you're going in for an elective surgery, for example, a knee surgery or something like that, and you don't want to go to the big hospital, you could go to a surgery center and then into a recovery care center. The beauty of this is it creates a new business model that hospitals can get into just as easily as anyone else can. Hospitals can own surgery centers and recovery centers. It's just a different format if you don't want to go into a larger full-service hospital setting.
Gotcha, gotcha. And switching gears again here, you've co-sponsored a bill to have Florida observe daylight savings time year-round. What's your rationale for supporting this bill, and how does it compare to, say, like another bill filed by Senator Greg Stube to end daylight savings time?
Well, I think Senator Stube and I have spoken, and he had relayed to me that he is supportive of this, that maybe we were both trying to get at the same thing, but as written initially, there may have been some confusion as to how to achieve it. So he is supportive of this bill.
Okay.
But what it will do is basically so we don't have – we can stay on one time all year. And to me, the ideal time for us to stay on is where we're not falling back when the weather gets nice and we want to be able to get outside and enjoy our evening and go for a walk, you know, throw the football with the kids, whatever it may be that you like to do. That this is our sweet zone, you know. We want to be able to enjoy it. So I think that's my main motivation is I think how many people am I going to make happy if they can come home at work and it's not dark?
Yeah, yeah. I definitely hear what you're saying there. I also have to say, though, the fallback is my favorite. I get an extra hour's sleep.
No,
I'm kidding. Firearm bill that you have sponsored as well. Sorry to switch gears on you yet again here. Can you tell me about that? Because this relates to, concealed carry permit holders.
It does. I wouldn't give it a lot of discussion simply because I know that it's not going to move forward in the Senate. But what the impetus for this bill was is the number of attacks that we've had lately at churches. And many churches today have educational facilities attached to them.
Schools, yeah.
Right. Or daycares, whatever it is, anything that's attached like that.
Right.
So when that happens, what that does is it creates a situation under our current law where you may not have a concealed carry on that property because it's not allowed. That includes any church staff. It includes any enforcement officers. Not sheriffs, but some private enforcement officer, security officer that they would want to have. Because right now, we're sending a message to those that would come with a gun and want to take lives at a church. We're saying, yeah, you can just come on in and shoot in this fishbowl because you can rest assured that there's no one here that's going to have a concealed weapon. So I wanted the church to be able to make a decision for their own parishioners on whether or not they want to have security personnel with a concealed firearm or how they want to address their own security concerns while they're at worship.
Does what you propose specifically address religious institutions?
Yes.
So this wouldn't be like the controversy we've seen over guns on public college and university campuses?
No.
Okay, okay. And so, again, you're saying it's not likely this is going to pass the Senate, but you think that this is an important thing to bring forward.
I do, but I am focusing my attention on other bills because I know that this one is not going to have, legs this time around.
Right, right. And you're also bringing back a proposal from a previous session that adds some kind of financial literacy and personal finance or money management education requirements to the next generation Sunshine State standards required for students to earn a standard high school diploma.
My favorite bill.
We've talked about this before.
I love this. Yeah. And I'm just going to keep on and keep on trying. But I'm telling you, it's looking good. The companion bill in the Senate, which is filed by Dorothy Huckel, Senator Huckel, has already passed the full Senate. And so it's already done. And I have gotten some assurances at the House that we can move forward very soon with this bill. And I think it's ideal. It would be so beneficial for Florida's students and families to have this education component, because regardless of how smart you are or what expertise you have, and if you're extremely successful in your area of expertise and you can't manage the money that you're making, you're not going to ultimately be in the successful place you want to be, because you have to have a mastery of these financial components or life skills. What is a contract? What is insurance? What do I need to look at? How do I budget? You know, what are things that I need to understand so at least I have a mastery of the rudimentary concepts so that I can ask questions as a young adult and moving forward to make the right choices for myself?
Yeah, I can just tell you personally, when I went to high school, and this was not in Florida, I took a class called Personal Finance.
There you go.
And I think it was one of the most useful classes I ever took.
Thank you.
and it's true. I think you do have some kids out there who like are whizzes at trigonometry, but, and maybe I'm dating myself with this term, don't know how to balance a checkbook.
Right. Yeah. You know, don't know how to use their Quicken to do, you know, projections for their budgeting, whatever it might be. But I think that it's so important. And it goes, I think, hand in hand with a renewed emphasis that we have now on recognizing that all kids aren't the same, and all students aren't necessarily college bound. They may be going to be to go into some trades and make a great living in as a contractor, as a plumber, whatever it might be. But they also need these skills so much. Even if they're thinking about starting a small business, you have to have a sense of your own personal finance before you can then expand that into a growing enterprise.
Right. It really transcends whatever career path you're going to go into. Let's talk firefighters, because you're championing a bill there.
I love the firefighters, and I love this bill to help them. And it's not – I make a prime co-sponsor this time around, but we actually have a firefighter in the House of Representatives that has taken this on. And, you know, I'm very proud of that, to be continuing to assist in that way.
And so what's the issue here? Firefighters aren't able to get what you think are you know, prudent and necessary disability benefits if they're diagnosed with cancer as it relates to what they maybe have been exposed to on the job.
Right. The way it works now is if you are diagnosed, there you have to prove that you got the cancer from your workplace, which, again, for someone who's going through cancer and then has to expend the time, energy, and money to prove that to get some kind of a benefit, that's a problem. What I'm trying to say is there is a vast amount of data in the United States that shows, without question, that there are a number of cancers that are appearing way more frequently in first responders and firefighters. So what this bill is saying is, let there be a presumption. If you have had a clean bill of health before, you don't do other things that would give you cancer, like smoke or that type of thing, but if you're going to put yourself in this position and work to help be a first responder and a firefighter, let's give you the presumption that we know you have an increased chance of getting these types of cancers.
Well, you've filed a bill providing provisions related to franchise businesses. What's that about?
Well, that's a controversial one, but essentially the main thing that I want to convey with the bill that I'd like to see happen is franchisees are small business owners. They have invested with a franchisor, which would be, again, a Taco Bell or, you know, a McDonald's. And they have invested and entered into a contract with that franchisor to do certain things. There is an imbalance of power, but, you know, that's just the nature of the beast when you're contracting with a large corporation and you're a small business person. The main thing that I would like to see happen is this. As it stands now, many of the contracts that are between these two parties allow for the franchisor, the larger corporation, to designate another state for the venue of any legal dispute that you might have over your contract. Couple that with, they may also be able to designate another state's law to apply to that foreign state's venue. Oh. So you have a franchisee who lives in Florida that may have to fly to California and then have New York law apply to this dispute. So there's a lot of problems inherent there. One, the franchisee has to leave the business and go someplace else in order to seek a resolution to their problem. You have to find an attorney that is licensed in that state to practice and has the ability to understand a law from another third state. So what I'm suggesting is if you want to do business in the state of Florida and we welcome you going forward in future contracts, you must have a venue to resolve your dispute in Florida and you must apply Florida law. And that's fine. So if you know, let's just work within those confines and be a little bit more reasonable for Florida businesses.
Okay. Yeah. So this is really about, securing the economic health of our communities.
It is.
Okay. Okay. You're sponsoring a bill that would tighten monitoring of registered sex offenders.
Yes, yes.
And I'm wondering why you think this is needed now, given the residency restrictions registered sex offenders already face as it relates to, the vicinity of where they live, to a school or a park or something, mm-hmm. and the change of address notification requirements that they already have to follow?
Because – a couple of reasons. Because they sometimes are more transitory than other members of the community. So they move more quickly and stay different places. And I think that it's not fair for the community members not to know when they have a transitory individual coming and going in the community, and the current law does not quite take that into account. The other thing is that the monitoring sometimes is not perfect. We have the ability for the monitors to be disengaged, and we also have situations where the monitor fails to work, or we have situations where the monitoring company, the third-party private monitoring company, does not respond quickly enough to allow for us to pursue that individual who is violating the rules of his probation or existence. So
right. Gotcha. Okay. And let's get into the appropriation bills, because mm-hmm. I think these are fun and have the most,
fun. I love it. I've never heard anyone call appropriations fun, but I like it.
Oh, what can I say? I'm a legislative nerd, I suppose. But these are those bills also that have the most tangible impact on your constituents,
yes.
too, or that have the capacity to. An appropriations bill related to Goodwheels, which serves as the major transportation provider for Medicaid patients, and mm-hmm. Not just Lee, but also Hendry and Glades County, portions of Collier as well, and also to providing private pay services to the general public. What's this about?
Well, I just have to give a shout out to Goodwheels because they do an exceptional job in our community. I cannot tell you, if you give Goodwheels a penny, you will get a dime worth of value out of what they do because they work so hard. Alan Mendel, who heads it up, has done an amazing job. He last year asked me to help with an appropriation for some software that would help them be able to manage their fleet and be able to get the transportation done more efficiently. We did that. Great. He's made that work beautifully. But he said, Heather, we have a gas tank, fuel tank that is failing us, and we really need to replace that. And so that's simply what this is. It's for a new fuel tank for Goodwheels, something that they need in order to keep working. And they were heroes during Irma. They helped so many people get where they needed to go and patients get where they needed to go to safety.
All right. Also, another appropriation request for the Harry Chapin Food Bank of Southwest Florida. And of course, we know through their, roughly 150, 160 partner agencies throughout our region, they facilitate the distribution of 22.3 million pounds of food in the 2016-2017 fiscal year, which I understand equates to 18.6 million meals.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And in terms of, again, going back to that return on investment, the way they're able to leverage their dollars.
Yes.
you know, I can go to Publix and what I can get as far as $1 worth of food, they can turn into $6 worth of food.
Absolutely. I mean, the return on investment here is fantastic. And again, they are, again, stars in our community. They stepped up during Hurricane Irma and made sure that people did not go hungry. So I am doing everything I can to make sure that we continue to fund Harry Chapin Food Bank because it just does such an outstanding job and our community is desperately in need of those continued services.
You know, Goodwill's, Harry Chapin, they seem like no-brainers.
They are to me.
But they're not necessarily shoo-ins given you've got other members of the legislature who want their own piece of the pie for their local projects.
Exactly. So, you know, we can't get everything that we want. Again, I can always advocate on behalf of these wonderful projects and hope that the majority of them get funded. But, you know, you just never know. But they're all very worthy.
Another local one, funding for Billy's Creek in Fort Myers. And for those who don't know, there's, you know, artificially created filter marshes at the preserve there. And the plants there are perform like, you know, the natural cleaning duties of that water before it goes into the Caloosahatchee. How did this just come up on your radar?
Well, this one, I live in the city of Fort Myers, and so I'm very in tune to some of the problems that we've had with the flooding and the discharges into the Caloosahatchee right there in the city. And what this is going to do is allow us to dredge and get rid of a lot of this accumulated silt that's got a lot of nitrates and so forth in it, phosphorus, so that we can get rid of that sediment. We can also take out some of the invasive species and create a better flow path for the water that needs to move into the river.
All right. All right. And you're among a long list of co-sponsors to a bill that would make texting while driving a primary offense, meaning that a law enforcement officer wouldn't have to have some other reason like speeding in order to pull somebody over and cite them for texting while driving. And in recent days, Governor Rick Scott has vocally supported such a move. Given that, plus the widespread support this measure is garnering, the well-documented dangers of distracted driving, and the fact that Florida is only one of five states that hasn't taken this step, is 2018 going to be the year we get this done?
Yes.
All right. And you're co-sponsoring a Victims of Human Trafficking bill that provides civil cause of action for victims of human trafficking against a trafficker or facilitator and would eliminate the statute of limitations for trafficking-related charges, among other things. Tell me more about what this bill would do and why it's needed.
Well, I love this bill because what it does is it hits the traffickers where it hurts, their pocketbooks. So this is designed to say to any hotelier or restaurateur or anything of that level that is knowingly, and I emphasize knowingly, allowing the perpetration of human trafficking to take place at their facility, there will be a ramification. You can't just turn a blind eye and pretend that you don't see what's going on when it's obvious that you do. So we're trying to hit it hard where it hurts in the pocketbook. So you'd have to pay a penalty. You would, you know, ideally have problems maintaining your business if you're allowing this heinous crime to take place at your business.
Do you think this is the culmination of, you know, I think, a lot of years of greater attention being paid to the issue of human trafficking? Like, I know when I started out in this business, it was not something you heard about in the news.
Absolutely. I was not really aware of it, but it's become an increasing problem. And so I'm glad that we are aggressively addressing it. And my colleague in the House, the head of the Criminal Justice Committee, Ross Spano, has done an exceptional job of shepherding this.
All right. And you're co-sponsoring the Advanced Well Stimulation Treatment Bill this year, or the fracking ban proposal. And your colleague, House Majority Leader Ray Rodriguez, and I have discussed this issue at great length in past years. And part of why he's opposed these bills in the past is that he points out that to date, there has been no study specific to Florida's porous limestone substrate that supports the idea that fracking in our state's unique geology would pose a risk. And he says without such a study, a fracking ban would be subject to legal challenges under the Burt Harris Private Property Rights Protection Act. And I know with your background as an attorney, I would love to get your take on that.
Well, I mean, I have the greatest respect for Leader Rodriguez, and we disagree on this particular issue. not fully disagree, but I guess I take a more stringent approach because I'm so concerned about our environment that this risk is too great for me to want to undertake. And I do think there is enough information out there that demonstrates that there is a high level of risk and it could be potentially damaging. It hasn't happened yet, but I don't want to wait for it to happen. I think that our delicate ecostructure here in Florida is not one that can withstand this type of intrusion. I will say that fracking is done other places and it isn't as dangerous there because of the strata that different states have that we do not. We have delicate limestone that's very porous, but they have their own ramifications when they've had fracking. A number of earthquakes occur because
Oklahoma.
You are making major, major shifts occur underneath the surface of you know, the planet. And that's pretty major.
Yeah. So you're saying this probably wouldn't be a Burt Harris issue?
It may be, but I'm willing to take – I don't think so, but I'm willing to take that risk.
Okay.
And then go from there.
Because, you know, speaking with you and you know, speaking with policy specialists with the Conservancy of Southwest mm-hmm. Florida, and you know, they're so certain that this poses an undue risk. And so I just have to ask again, if we are so certain, why not just fund the study to prove it?
Well, I'm perfectly willing to have a study funded. Let's get on with it. And in the meantime, though, why don't we just you know, go ahead and ban it? We can always unban it if the study finds that it's not accurate.
And you're co-sponsoring a bill that's also being challenged championed in the Senate by your fellow Southwest Florida Legislative Delegation member Lizbeth Beniquisto relating to banning marriage of minors in Florida.
I quite frankly was stunned to learn that this was still going on in this day and time. There's just no situation that I could think that there would be any argument to allowing this to occur. So I'm very happy that Senator Beniquisto has brought this great bill forward.
And I'm sure you maybe have heard testimony from you know, women who were married as minors in Florida.
Yes.
I would use the word coerced based on their
yes.
testimony.
Right. Absolutely coerced. There's no reason for it. There are enough safety measures in place that you don't have to get married at that time in your life. So there's just no reason for that to be occurring. I mean, we're not back in the days of the Conestoga wagons when people were getting married, you know, at age, you know, 13 or 14 right. and heading west or something like that. We're you know, this is the modern era and there's no necessity for this.
And you're co-sponsoring a bill that would expand discrimination protections to include sexual orientation and gender identity in the areas of public lodging establishments and public food service establishments. Is your support of this bill somewhat out of step with what's traditionally been considered the Republican Party's position on such issues?
I don't think so, because the way I look at it, the Republican Party stands for, you know, freedom for everyone. And everyone includes this specialty group that still seems to be having some occurrence of discrimination. So we are not for discrimination. We're for freedom. So I don't think it is. I think it's something that we just need to address more specifically because, again, as time has evolved, these particular groups in our population have become more outspoken and more prevalent and made their case to say that this is happening to them and they're not feeling that the protections are inclusive of them.
I'm wondering about your prospects for passage of this bill, given that I know for the past several legislative sessions, different lawmakers have proposed you know, anti-discrimination protections for LGBTQ people in the workplace, and that bill still hasn't passed.
It hasn't, but I guess one of the things that's interesting is that the large hospitality groups like Disney and large hotel chains, they tend to have a higher percentage of this type of employee, and so they are championing, I can never say that, this too. So I think it's important to understand that there are large Florida business concerns that want to make sure that these these groups are protected.
Okay. Okay. So there's even, you know, an economic benefit.
Absolutely. Yeah. Because companies want to be able to recruit here when they come to Florida and say, you have the full protection of the law, and our anti-discrimination policies here in Florida make it acceptable for all members of a society to come into the workplace and use their skills in whatever business you decide you elect to go to work for.
Right, like Governor Scott's message of jobs and you know, his history of traveling to other states and trying to get businesses to relocate here to Florida. And you're saying if these companies can say my LGBT employees will be protected if we relocate, that could
– Absolutely.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And well, are there any legislative proposals or issues that we haven't covered that you think we should highlight?
My goodness, I think we've run the gamut. The
yes.
only one that you didn't really touch on was there's an appropriation for the expansion of the STARS complex.
Oh, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
That's a great facility in downtown Fort Myers. And I think that we could make it even better so that the community can access it and have more of a robust facility. And so I'm excited about that appropriation as well.
All right. And, you know, as we look to enter the third week of this state legislative session, what specific items are on your agenda or what's going to be in your line of sight for this third week?
Well, the third week is going to hold another meeting of the Civil Justice Committee, which I chair. So I'm spending a lot of time vetting all the bills that come before civil justice. So that's a large part of my focus right now. Also, the CON repeal or certificate of need is going to be heard on the House floor and voted on this next week. So I am going to be all hands on deck for that.
All right. And just to end our conversation here, I wanted to ask more of a personal question about, you know, what kind of law did you practice before becoming a lawmaker, and what made you want to seek public office in the first place?
Well, I had a unique background. I worked at a firm called AIG, American International Group, in their legal department. And what they had different broker-dealers or investment arms, and that's where I worked. So I wasn't a practicing attorney per se, but worked in an internal legal department. And then I had my two children. One had a little bit of a health stumble early on, and so I decided to stay home and raise the kids. And then ultimately, I got back involved, very involved in the community civically and so forth. And someone came to me when we had redistricting 6 years ago and said, why not run for this new seat that we got in Fort Myers? And, you know, I thought about it and I was quite hesitant because I wasn't sure that I was the best person for the job. But I knew in my heart that I wanted to serve more and have a bigger impact. And I took that step and I've never looked back. I'm so happy that I did it. It's so fulfilling and it's really a tremendous honor to be able to serve our community in this way.
Well, Fort Myers State Representative Heather Fitzenhagen, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.
Our show today was produced by Mike Canary, our director, Richard Cinqui, and yours truly. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm John Davis. This is WGCU-FM, Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.